Judge Decker, as well as Ms. Burrows on the line. This is the matter, case of Eric Christopher McCarter against the Commonwealth, continued from our June panel. Ms. Burrows, you represent the appellant. Would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
If I could reserve 3 minutes of my time.
All right, we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready, then.
All right, thank you. Good morning, judges. Good morning, opposing counsel. As the court mentioned, my name is Joan Burrows. I'm here for Mr. McCarter today. I believe the assignment of error that has been granted by the court and that we'll be talking about today has to do with the admissibility of the testimony by Officer, I think it's Blaisdell is the pronunciation, and whether that testimony constituted inadmissible hearsay. And obviously, Mr. McCarter and I would contend that it does constitute admissible hearsay, simply because it was based on a photograph of the driver's license, and he had no basis of personal knowledge other than looking at the photograph, and therefore constituted inadmissible hearsay and should not have been considered by the court. As the court is well aware, hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Again, the statement in contention here would be the officer's testimony regarding the victim's age, as it was gleaned from a photo.
Counsel, this is Judge Austin. Can you? And I read your brief, obviously, but can you tell us how you believe that this particular issue has been preserved on the record?
Yes, Judge, and I understand the Commonwealth, and I'm guessing the court as well, has some concerns about the preservation here. And I would like to kind of differentiate, and I would also like to tell the court, too, I was not counsel at trial, nor was I the counsel that provided the written materials for this, so I will tell the court, though, with regards to the specific hearsay objection that was made. In the record during trial, when opposing counsel for the Commonwealth was beginning to cross-examine, or beginning to examine Officer Blaisdell about the age of the one of the victims here, I believe it was at page 135 to 137 in the joint appendix. While the officer was looking at a picture of the license, trial counsel objected on the basis of hearsay, and that objection was overruled, and the officer was allowed to testify as to the age based on that picture, and I would submit to the court that that objection was sufficient enough to preserve this for appeal and for consideration.
Can I follow up on Judge Austin's question? This is Judge Humphreys, Ms. Burrows. Just to make it clear, assuming we get past all, let's assume we agree with you that there is error here. The remedy is simply a remand, correct, for a new trial.
Correct.
I mean, there's the sufficient. You know, if we were to do a sufficiency analysis, we would consider all the evidence, even that which is improperly
right.
admitted on that. So can we agree that your best case scenario here, if we agree with you, is simply a new trial
Absolutely, Judge. I think looking at Ms. Rainey's the petition and then her opening brief, I think that there may have been some combination of assignments of error here. I think her reasoning was, my understanding would be, there was an issue with the admissibility of the evidence in question, and but for that evidence, the Commonwealth case with regard to the contributing to delinquency of a minor would not have been sufficient. The Commonwealth case without that piece of evidence from Officer Blaisdell would not have been sufficient. So
that's why I asked the question. Of
right.
course, there's a new statute that was enacted last year that basically makes it clear that we would consider even improperly admitted evidence in the sufficiency argument. So then,
right.
my follow-up question to that would simply be: an objection was made here on hearsay grounds. Had the information come in, I know the license itself was not admitted. There is a statute, I think, that permits photographs of public records to come in. So if this meets the public record exception, any error would be harmless error, would it not be?
Well, Judge, I don't think that it meets the public records exception because we're not dealing with the actual license. I think we'd be in a completely different position had the Commonwealth offered the actual license. Or maybe even if the Commonwealth had offered a picture of both sides of the license or a better picture than what was offered, because the picture that was offered was not even just of the license. It was a picture of a license within, I believe it was a wallet, And so you can't see the sides of it, you can't see the back of it. And so the business records exception applies because, generally speaking, when you have the business records, you have some indicia of reliability within that business record, such as a seal or something like that.
Well, how do you deal with code 46.2-215, which permits, it says, whenever any record, including records maintained by electronic media, by photographic process, or paper in the office of the department, this is meaning the Department of Motor Vehicles, is admissible in evidence, a copy, a machine-produced transcript, or a photograph of the record or paper attested by the commissioner as designee may be admitted in evidence. How do you get around
that? I don't think that the photograph offered here was one taken by the DMV and therefore not attested to by the DMV. Again, I think the other problem here is that when we're dealing with a business record, generally like a DMV record, even if we had the license itself, you have the full record there in front of you to examine. Here,
so
we
your position then isn't so much one that speaks of hearsay in its traditional form, but when we get to this second layer for the exception of hearsay, you're saying that there's an authentication problem.
I think there's an authentication problem, exactly, Judge. I think had we had the actual license in court, the judge and then eventually the jury would be able to look at that license, see if there is the appropriate indicia of reliability that comes along with the license, the holograms, the appropriate placement of the picture, the items that show up on the back and things like that. But without that, if you're just looking at a picture, there is no there's no way to determine whether or not this is authentic. Again, I do think that if they'd had the actual license in court, that would be something completely different. And I do think even if the officer had testified that he had personal knowledge of the information contained in the license, we'd be in a different position. But he says that he doesn't even, I believe at page 135, when asked, did you see any identification of Tiffany's? I do not recall was his answer. So he doesn't have a personal basis of knowledge for this either.
Counsel?
So, yes.
We understand all that, but did you, or obviously trial counsel, did trial counsel object to the authentication piece? In other words, the photo of the driver's license was admitted not only without objection, but counsel essentially acquiesced in that. How does that put this issue? What posture is this issue on appeal now?
Right, and I realize the Commonwealth also raised the same issue in their response brief, and I would put to the court that I think there needs to be, and it's a very minute distinction that we have to make here, but the objection that counsel made that preserved this issue was to the officer's testimony based on the picture of the license. I think, so by agreeing that the picture came in and acquiescing to the admission of the picture, I think she still had her objection and her argument as to the hearsay proffered by the officer. I think that was still preserved because her issue was not so much with the picture, it's with the information the officer gleaned from the picture that was used for the truth of the matter to prove the Commonwealth's case that the victim was under the age of 18. Because if this had been followed through to the conclusion here, had the court sustained her objection, then at the motion to strike, the evidence would not have been found sufficient. Therefore, even though the picture is in evidence, it's not going to be considered because it's no longer relevant because that charge would have been stricken. So I think
your position, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, is that the general hearsay objection preserved the issue. The Commonwealth's response would be that there's an exception to the hearsay rule by statute, and your argument would be that that doesn't apply because we have an authentication problem. And because there's an authentication problem and there's no practical exception to the hearsay rule, the hearsay objection preserved the issue for this court to consider it.
Yes, yes, Judge, that would be our position. Again, in response, going back to Judge Decker's question, I do think it is a very minute difference. I don't think that the objection here is per se to the picture itself. It's to the information the officer provided based on that picture.
This is Judge Humphreys. Let me follow up on Judge Alston's question. I know you adopted his position, but I'm just wondering if we need to go that far. I shouldn't say his position, or the hypothetical that he, or the argument that he suggested you were making. I don't. I'm just wondering if we need to go that far, because as I understand this record, the deputy testified. There was clearly a hearsay objection that was overruled. Now, if we just stop there, and focus on simply whether or not the deputy's testimony should have been admitted, it seems to me that the objection is sufficiently specific as to not be procedurally defaulted. Then, of course, the burden shifts to the Commonwealth to establish that an exception applies. And so in terms of preservation, I don't know that you need to do much more than simply object on hearsay grounds. But the court having overruled the objection, I think then it becomes an issue for us to determine whether or not the error, if it exists, was harmless. And my understanding of your brief, at least, is simply that looking beyond the bare objection, it's not harmless because it's literally the only evidence of an element of the offense. And we're not dealing with sufficiency here, but it's the only evidence of the element of the offense. So it's part of a harmless error analysis as opposed to a preservation of the issue analysis. Would you agree with that?
I would, Judge, and I think that's precisely why it is not harmless error. I think, you know, had the Commonwealth provided some other indicator of age, then certainly we would be in a different, again, in a different position. But I think because that is the only way that the Commonwealth was able to prove the age of both the girl whose license was presented as well as her twin sister, then I do think that that is what makes this error not harmless.
Well, counsel, what about the fact that trial counsel did not object to the admission of the photo of the driver's license?
Yes, Judge. I do think that since her contention was not so much with the photograph as it was with the information that the officer provided based on that photograph, I think simply agreeing that that photograph came into evidence didn't waive her objection with regard to the officer's testimony.
Well, but assuming that the photo of the driver's license is worth anything in terms of the quality of the photo, if that photo was legible and you could see it as a driver's license and there was no objection to its admissibility, then doesn't the deputy's testimony become irrelevant?
No, Judge, I don't think that that's the case, because I think the picture, I think trial counsel's objection, and I think the result, had that objection been granted, is what is important to consider, had that objection been sustained, is what's important to consider here, because had her objection been sustained, I think perhaps this is why she gets into the sufficiency argument in her brief, then we're at a point where that motion, at the motion to strike, without the officer's testimony, they wouldn't have had, the Commonwealth would not have had sufficient evidence to prove the contributing to a delinquency of a minor charge. And so I think, but for his testimony, the picture would not have been considered. I'm not sure if I'm making my point clearly enough for the panel, and I apologize if it's not coming out the right way. But I think we don't get to the picture because the officer's testimony should not have been admitted. So I hope that
So your point is that the only reason the photo was admitted was to provide the deputy with a basis to say she was 16?
Yes. Yes, Judge. And if the panel has any other questions, I'm happy to address them. I would like to spend, I believe I've got a few minutes left. The Commonwealth brought up a couple different cases that I think are distinctive from this case and are distinguishable from this case. The Commonwealth brought up Smoot versus the Commonwealth. I think there it's distinguishable because in Smoot they had the actual DMV record. Here we only have a photograph of it. The same thing in the Cooper versus Commonwealth case was brought up. There, the court ruled that the NCIC was admissible as a business record, Again, we run into the same problem. They had the actual NCIC there. They did not simply have a photograph of it. And finally, the Commonwealth also brought up Frye versus the Commonwealth, again, dealing with the NCIC. Once again, the court there admitted it because they had the actual record in front of them. I think the problem here is the fact that had we had the actual license so that it could be examined and made sure that it was a legitimate, not a fake identification or a fake license, then I think that would have been different. But since we only have a picture, and it's only a picture of the front of the license, that's not enough to make it admissible. And I think any testimony that the officer gave based on that photograph constituted an admissible hearsay. And so with that, judges, I would cede the rest of my time to rebuttal, unless the panel has any other questions.
Apparently we have none, so Rose will reserve your time. Ms. Martin, let me start you off with following up on Judge Decker's question, if you would. Let's assume for the purpose of my question, there is a hearsay error here on the part of the deputy who testified. The license, as the way it came in, is basically a photograph of the wallet with the things face up, showing what it shows, which is, frankly, from at least my perspective, looking at the both the joint appendix photograph and the exhibit, are illegible in terms of showing a date of birth. In fact, not even a name. I mean, you can discern that there's a photograph of a woman on there and what may be a state seal, and that's pretty much it. Given that, that there's simply no other information concerning age in the record, I mean, the exhibit certainly speaks for itself, but the exhibit is the photograph, which is illegible, and the hearsay statement of the officer. And I'm not arguing or not suggesting a sufficiency deficiency here. I'm simply, from an evidentiary standpoint, where does that leave us? If from a harmless error analysis, how, assuming for the purpose of my question that admitting the deputy's testimony was error, how do we do a harmless error analysis with what's left in the evidence?
I believe that if the court were to find that the deputy's testimony was hearsay and should not have come in, and the exhibit itself is not readable in terms of showing any specific concrete information, then I think that you'd have to say that it was not harmless error because there's really no other evidence of age in the record. There was some testimony in the beginning, and I keep losing my voice, I'm sorry, where the officer said when he first came, there were a bunch of juveniles outside, and he checked their IDs, and they were juveniles, and that the defendant's daughters were there at that point. Then later on, he said, well, he wasn't really sure whether the daughters were out there or not. But other than that, there is no other evidence in the record as to the ages of these two girls. So, I mean, I think that the Commonwealth would have to say that if this evidence should not have come in, that it couldn't have been a harmless error.
Thank you.
But, you know, to get back to the initial points that we have made here, one of the things that defense counsel just merely said that hearsay, and she gave no other specific grounds for her objection. Now, on her brief, and what we were talking about in the procedural bar part of our response brief was that she was trying to argue that it didn't come under the business records exception. Well, business records, official records, none of that came out at trial. That was not before the judge. So the point would be that, you know, she can't really bring in that particular argument at this point.
Isn't that a rebuttal argument as opposed to the primary argument? If an objection is made based upon hearsay and there's an exception to the hearsay rule that is articulated by the opponent of the evidence, isn't it then the responsibility for the lawyer who made the original hearsay objection to rebut the suggestion that there's an exception, as opposed to the judge just simply overruling the objection without making reference to or counsel making reference to the exception to the rule?
Well, I think still that, you know, the case law is such that, and the Neal case comes to mind, that the defense, you know, has to give, you know, they have to give some sort of reasoning, some sort of specific grounds. I mean, if you're going to say, well, you can't come back on appeal and make some brand new argument that was never given
so you're suggesting what trial counsel should have said is, objection, Your Honor, hearsay, this is not an exception to the business records exception to the hearsay rule.
Well, I think that she could have put forth some grounds as to why she thought that it was hearsay. Hearsay covers a lot of things, and so that was our point as far as that goes. And we would
but
also...
Hearsay is really, I mean, it's simply an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and I mean, that's all you need to do is object on hearsay grounds. Now, if something is hearsay, it's not admissible unless it fits within an exception. That's sort of evidence 101, and I'm struggling to understand why you're suggesting that it's the responsibility of defense counsel not only to say this is objectionable on hearsay grounds, but basically go through every exception that arguably may apply and assert why it doesn't apply in order to preserve the point for the record.
Well, we made that argument, Your Honor, simply because we just felt like that you couldn't make a different argument on appeal that you had made had not made at trial.
Counsel, I guess our problem with that is that assuming the objection was hearsay because he didn't have personal knowledge or whatever, or just a simple hearsay objection, then it becomes the Commonwealth's burden to say, no, it's not hearsay because it falls under the business record or government document exception or whatever it may be, and then the defense might come back with something else. In this case, it's being raised on brief because the Commonwealth never raised it, so counsel is saying why it doesn't apply in the event that we were to find that it was admissible because it fell under one of those exceptions.
Right, and I understand that, and I think it's simply, you know, maybe a difference in interpretation in terms of what it appeared that defense counsel was trying to argue was that this was just some sort of other brand new thing. But I think that the other point, aside, just putting that aside, is that we could make the argument, and first of all, the first time that on page 135, when the officer was asked, were you able to determine how old Tiffany was, because they were talking about Tiffany's room, and he said 16, and defense counsel had said, objection, lacks personal knowledge. And then he said, I don't recall if I saw any identification. And that statement about whether or not she was 16, then that later was the jury was told to disregard that. Then he's shown these pictures. There was a picture of the driver's license that was sort of as a recollection, a refreshment of his recollection. And then he was asked how old she was, and he said she was, there was an objection, hearsay, and then she said court overruled, and he said then that she was 16, and that these girls were twin sisters. And so we would make the argument that certainly that this really wasn't even hearsay. I mean, he was looking at the driver's license that refreshed his recollection of what he had seen when he had seen the driver's license. And he saw the driver's license in the room the same way that he saw the beer cans and the marijuana cigars and everything else that was in that room that he testified to. And so he is simply, you know, this was not, he wasn't saying, well, I know how old she is because somebody else in the house told me how old she was. He saw some specific
Let me follow up. I appreciate your argument, but that's not refreshing recollection because he said he didn't know. Refreshing recollection is when someone doesn't recall something and then is provided some piece of evidence or something, some demonstrative exhibit or whatever, that jogs their memory that allows them to remember something that they did have independent knowledge of. In this case, from the way I read the record, and please feel free to correct me, I don't see anywhere where he actually knows the age of the person involved, and is thereby having his recollection refreshed. So isn't that a little bit different?
Well, I'm looking at, he was asked, did you see any identification? And he said, I do not recall. And then the next thing is, I'm going to show you these, can you tell the ladies and gentlemen, the jury, if you recognize what these pictures show? And then he says, those were pictures of the evidence seized, marijuana seeds, cigar ends, and also a picture and a driver's license for Tiffany. And so then he's asked, well, how old was she according to her driver's license? So, I mean, I think that that's kind of where that information came from.
But again, following up on Judge Alston's question, the answer he gave where he said he didn't recall, the question put to him at that point was, were you shown any identification? So he certainly theoretically could have had his recollection refreshed and then been able to come back and answer that question that he didn't recall the answer to by saying, yes, I was shown identification, or no, I was not, either way. But that would be the limit, it seems to me, to what he would be able to have his recollection refreshed about. I think that's the point Judge Alston made. So as far as the substantive information of age, unless he was present at these twins' birth, I don't see how his information could be anything other than hearsay information, and there was an objection on those grounds made. So the only other issue is there an exception to the hearsay rule that applies to that testimony?
And to speak to that point, Your Honor, that we would say that there would be an exception, that the driver's license could be seen as a business record or as an official record, that certainly that this was not just some piece of paper lying around that had somebody's birth date written on it. I mean, this
well, if the license itself had been introduced into evidence, it could be well taken, but it wasn't. We have this photograph of a wallet that has a license in it, and the question is whether that satisfies the public record statute, or with respect to business record, you need a custodian. I don't think this deputy testified he was any kind of a custodian of the records of DMV.
But I think that we would say that the picture that exists in the appendix, of course, is pretty poor quality, and the, as I recall, the picture that's in the record there at the court. I couldn't really see what it said, but I don't know whether that was the actual exhibit or whether there was a better photograph that might have been shown to the jury. And maybe somebody with better eyesight than I've got was able to really see what it said. And I think that, certainly the driver's license is assumed to be an accurate representation of what it purports to be.
Let's turn it around, Ms. Martin, and I appreciate this is difficult, but let's turn it around a little bit. Suppose a person was being charged with underage possession of alcohol, and the person had a fake Virginia ID, and they said, here's an indication that I am indeed old enough to have alcohol, because this particular document that I'm presenting that's not been authenticated, that hasn't met the business records exceptions that's provided in the statute, proves that I am old enough to have alcohol, and so therefore I want it admitted. Obviously, the government would object to that. Why isn't that still the analytical framework we should apply here?
Well, I think that because it's a different charge, I think that, and if you're talking about a fake ID and possession of a fake ID, I just think that that's a much different charge where you'd be looking at the proof a little differently. But here, it's contributing to a delinquency of a minor, and so they had to be under 18. And it's just not reasonable that this is a fake ID, because it would have shown that they were older than 18 or 21 or something. And so I think that the fact that, we had this, the officer, and I think that, we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth in terms of the officer goes into this room, he sees all of these items, he takes pictures of these items, and that based on what he saw in that room, he could say that the girls were 16, that they were under 18. And so certainly...
Well, Mr. Spartan, I'm getting confused now, and I'm just a simple person, so let me see if we can get back to the fundamental issue. Was the testimony of the deputy hearsay or not? And if it was hearsay, which exception to the hearsay rule does the Commonwealth assert applies? The license itself seems to me is a separate issue. It's in evidence, and it says what it says or doesn't say what it doesn't say. I mean, but I think the point we're trying to get at, initially at least, is what is the status of the deputy's testimony? Was it admissible or not admissible? And if so, on what grounds?
All right. Well, Well, the Commonwealth, first of all, would say that the testimony was not hearsay, and that if it was hearsay, then
was it not offered for the truth of the matter asserted?
Well, it was. But I'm trying to get at, Your Honor, I mean, the argument that I'm making for whatever it's worth is that it wasn't hearsay because it wasn't something that somebody else told him. It was something that he saw, and that's where his information came from. He could say that he saw this the same way that he saw the other items in the room. So that it was not hearsay, but if it were hearsay, then it certainly could be a business record or it could be an official record, and that's how it was admissible. Now, as I said to begin with, if the court disagrees with that, well, then I don't really have anything else that I can offer.
Okay, thank you.
So I have a question, counsel. In terms of that photo of the driver's license, the court has looked at the record just as you have, and let's assume we come to the same conclusion that it's essentially not readable when it comes to the name or the age. Does that matter in terms of the fact that you argue that they failed to object to the admissibility of the photograph and that the photograph basically bolsters the testimony of the deputy?
Well, I think that the photograph does bolster the deputy's testimony, and so I think that
I guess the question, does it matter?
I'm not sure I really understood your question. I think I'm confused.
Does it matter that the photograph of the driver's license is not readable, assuming that the deputy saw the original?
Right. No, I don't think that it does matter.
So I think your point, what you're saying is that it is refreshing his recollection of the original that he saw at the scene.
Right. Right. And so his testimony was just not something that, you know, he just made up. It was based on something specific that he saw, and then when those pictures came in, and it shows that there is a driver's license and that corroborated what he said. And that's kind of where we are.
Thank you.
Anything else, Ms. Martin?
No, sir. I think as far as the sufficiency goes, I think that the court has you know, addressed that appropriately in terms of the statute. You look at all the evidence. I would point out that, you know, the assignment of error only talks about the daughter's age. It doesn't talk about some of the other things that were argued in the brief in terms of the defendant's age or the defendant's conduct. And that if you look at the written motion to set aside, that didn't even really mention the daughter's ages either. So there may be some question, if you were looking at just a purely sufficiency issue, whether any of that was actually properly preserved. But the hearsay question is the issue that's really before the court. And we would ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Ms. Burroughs, you, I think, have about 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Judge. I'll start by responding to the Commonwealth's position that the hearsay objection in court was not enough. I think I'll pick up on Judge Alston and Judge Humphrey's comments that hearsay is per se inadmissible. Certainly there are exceptions to that, but I think since the Commonwealth was the proponent of the evidence here, it was upon them to say why it was not hearsay or why it was admissible hearsay. I think to expect the defense attorney to do otherwise, or to expect the person objecting to the evidence to do otherwise, is expecting them to kind of look into the other opposing counsel's mind, figure out what their position is, and then respond to it. I just don't think that that's realistic. I know the Commonwealth relied on the Neal case to support that position, but I think that Neal is slightly different here because in that case, the appellant was the proponent of the evidence. So certainly since they were the proponent of the evidence, it was upon them to make the argument as to why it was admissible. Here, the defense was not the party asking that the license picture be introduced, so I don't think that it was not defense counsel's responsibility to anticipate what the Commonwealth argument was going to be and then respond to it. I realize the Commonwealth argues that we're making an argument here that was not made at trial court, and I would put to the court that's not true. We objected at trial saying it was hearsay, and we're arguing here that it's hearsay. So I don't think that there's any big difference here between what's made at the trial court versus what's made here on appeal. In response to the Commonwealth's argument that this was a business record, again, I would just point the court to both the Frye case and the Cooper case. I think Frye indicates that you have to have one of the custodians of the record there, and certainly the police officer was not a custodian of the record. I think had we had a picture from the DMV that was authenticated by the DMV either through a stamp or through some sort of certified copy of the license, then that's a different position altogether. But where we have no indication this photo was taken by anybody having to do with the DMV who was the custodian of the record, there is no authentication there, and thus it shouldn't have been admitted. And I will simply say, Your Honor, I think it's on the Commonwealth to prove every element of their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Part of the elements of the contributing charge was that they had to prove that the victims were under the age of 18, since the license picture was the only basis for that, that they did not prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. But again, judges, I would submit that the sufficiency argument, I don't think that we really get there. I think that so long as the court finds that this was hearsay testimony, as it should, and that it was inadmissible hearsay testimony, this needs to be remanded for new trial, and that would be my request to the court.
Counsel, let me ask you one final question, and this might seem like a very simple question. Judge Humphrey said that he was a simple man. I'm simpler than him, so please help me work through this.
I'll stipulate.
Please help me work through this. If we were to agree with your position, the practical implication of what we would do would be to reverse and remand this case for a new trial. And if we were to agree with your position again, what the Commonwealth is going to do is they're going to say, okay, we've got a primer as to how we're supposed to fix this case. We're just going to go down to the DMV and get a certified record of this young person's driver's license. And when we come back and try this case, we're going to offer this exhibit, and it will come in as an exception to the hearsay rule, and we'll end up with a conviction anyway. So why is what we're doing important, I guess, from a policy standpoint?
Well, Judge, I think it's important because it's sending the message that the Commonwealth, the way, you know, that you just indicated that the Commonwealth would do it should this be remanded, that's how the Commonwealth should have done it in the first place. And so I think by taking this issue up and forcing the Commonwealth to meet that burden, from a policy perspective, the court is saying, look, you can't just have a photo, you can't just come in here with, you know, this low level of evidence. You're holding the Commonwealth to their burden. You're sending a very loud and clear message that this type of practice is not acceptable. And I think that when you're dealing with somebody's liberty, when you're dealing with sending somebody to jail, even for 12 months on a misdemeanor charge like this one, you have to do it by the book. You have to hold them to their burden. I think that is a very worthwhile and timely message that this court needs to send. So I think that's why it's important from a policy perspective.
I appreciate that.
All right, thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments, and the court will now adjourn to conference. Thank you very much.
Thank you.